I'm Abigail Galvan. Welcome to EWTN Pro-Life Weekly.
We always look for ways in which we can collaborate with the administration, with members of Congress and the like.
The future of the church in the United States. Church leaders share their hopes for promoting the dignity of life in a new Trump administration.
I think it's very important that a Trump administration make sure that there are very clear conscience rights and religious exemptions.
Understanding the concerns of a potential in vitro fertilization mandate. Senior fellow at the Catholic Association, Ashley McGuire, weighs in.
It's been really impressive, the way that people have mobilized.
The pro-life movement's key work in raising public awareness about an assisted suicide measure in the United Kingdom that is weeks away from a vote in Parliament.
In areas where the positions and actions that are taken are contrary to the teaching of the church, then we'll express our great concern.
The U.S. bishop's remark on working with the new presidential administration to defend life. The U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops are meeting for the annual fall plenary assembly in Baltimore this week. President of the USCCB, Archbishop Timothy Broglio, called on the assembly to uphold church teaching on human dignity in the wake of recent national elections. Immigration and abortion emerged as primary topics of discussion at the assembly. Broglio later joined Bishop Mark Seitz of the Diocese of El Paso and Bishop Michael Burbage of the Diocese of Arlington for a media conference focused on human dignity. They were not only asked about immigration, but also about lessons learned from the abortion ballot measures that passed in several states.
The ballot initiatives, we have learned that it is very important to be ahead of the game. To get out early in messaging, because the truth has to be conveyed concisely and in a clear way to all the faithful, because distortion of the truth has been a big part of these about initiatives.
The bishops say they will never be able to financially keep up with pro-abortion campaigns, so they have to rely on the truth and, of course, prayer.
As part of our efforts to help working families, I'm announcing today in a major statement that under the Trump administration, your government will pay for, or your insurance company will be mandated to pay for, all costs associated with IVF treatment, fertilization for women, IVF treatment.
President-elect Donald Trump's promise to provide in vitro fertilization, or IVF, for families struggling to conceive. It's a big promise and one that doesn't sit well with some pro-life organizations and is at odds with church teaching. IVF involves removing a woman's eggs, combining them with sperm in a laboratory, and then transferring the fertilized eggs or embryos to a patient's uterus. Throughout this process, many embryos can be created, and many are often frozen indefinitely or even destroyed. The church teaches that IVF is morally unacceptable because it involves the use of artificial means to achieve pregnancy outside of the marital act between a husband and wife. It also treats embryos or children as commodities instead of human beings with souls and unnaturally manipulates the natural process of procreation. Here to talk more about IVF and other top pro-life stories is Ashley McGuire, senior fellow with the Catholic Association and co-host of the nationally syndicated radio show Conversations with Consequences. Thank you for being with us today, Ashley.
Thanks for having me.
Do you think President-elect Trump will make good on his promise to federalize IVF treatment? And what does that look like for the taxpayers?
Well, I think there's a couple of important factors if he does actually follow through with that. The first is conscience rights and religious liberty. I mean, you have a significant percentage of the healthcare industry and population, hospitals, employers, who have religious objections to IVF because of the fact that it destroys innocent unborn life. And we've sort of been there before with this when you had a national mandate like this under Obama, and it led to the biggest religious liberty class action lawsuit in history. So I think it's very important that a Trump administration make sure that there are very clear conscience rights and religious exemptions for those employers and industries. And then secondly, you know, for the taxpayers, the world of IVF is kind of the wild, wild west. I mean, there's virtually no regulations on that industry. And so I think that's another thing that's important, is that the taxpayers should expect some common sense measures that protect the women that are using it.
And you touched on this a little bit, but California Governor Gavin Newsom signed a bill into law expanding fertility insurance coverage in the state, requiring health policies to cover IVF treatment. There are at least 10 other states that already have IVF coverage laws. Do you think this issue should be left up to the states the way abortion has been?
I mean, I think it's always better to have these issues being decided as close to the voters as possible. I mean, that's even a Catholic principle that we believe in. So, you know, I do think that's better, because those legislators are going to be much more in touch with and attuned with the interests and concerns of the people and the industries that they're representing.
And do you think we'll get to the point where Catholics do have to sue the government for an exemption for this mandate, as they did with the Obama administration?
Well, President Trump in his first administration was really great about religious liberty. I mean, he went, not only did he restore a lot of the protections that were eroded under the previous administration, but, you know, he did things like go out of his way to establish a new division within the Department of Health and Human Services to make sure that, for example, the conscience rights of healthcare workers were not being violated when it came to different procedures. So I'm optimistic that this administration will, that his second administration will continue to be strong on religious liberty. But I think it's important, you know, that we're having these conversations right now as Catholics to make sure that those concerns don't get washed away or overlooked.
Yeah, that's so true. Now, Vice President-elect J.D. Vance has indicated a need for more laws to support the family. What kind of laws do you think would be most useful in promoting the nuclear family and helping women especially know that they're supported?
Well, I think it's great that, you know, we have a vice president, incoming vice president, who's made it clear that family should be at the forefront of legislation and policy. That's an exciting new chapter. But I think we also have to tread carefully and make sure that, as some people have pointed out, that we're not creating policies that create new incentives that further erode at or incentivize the continued deterioration of marriage and family. And also have to be sort of clear-eyed about the fact that in a lot of places, they've tried these policies, and they haven't exactly had always the results that we're looking for. But no, I do think that there's a lot of fertile ground to try out new laws that can help women and families. I think, for example, a great starting point would be with adoption. You know, let's make it less financially burdensome. Let's make it a full-on, you know, tax write-off, the expenses that families incur when they adopt a child. I think that's one thing. I think, you know, let's revive Marco Rubio's proposal to let couples draw down early on their social security and use some of the money that they have been putting away from their paychecks when they need it to pay for things like diapers and formula, and push back by just a few months or maybe even a year or two when they're drawing it down as retirees. I mean, there's so, when I first started writing about and talking about pro-family policies, there was basically nothing on the table other than the left's proposal, which is just a top-down mandate that's not practical, it's not economical, and it's not something that people want. So I think it's exciting that there's now so many different proposed policies that I can't even keep them all straight.
It's exciting indeed. Thank you so much for being with us, Ashley.
Thank you.
pro-life victories in election 2024. As EWTN News has reported, ballot measures in three states supporting life won this election cycle. In South Dakota, 59% of the voters voted against Amendment G, which would have constitutionalized a so-called right to abortion in the first trimester, with loose wording allowing for abortion in the second and third trimesters. The law there that protects babies during all 9 months of pregnancy will stay in place. A push in Nebraska to extend the current 12-week abortion limit to 24 weeks failed. Voters decided against Measure 439, which would have extended abortion until viability around 24 weeks. The current 12-week limit will remain in place. In Florida, some 57% of voters were in favor of an abortion measure, but it still failed to pass because of a law requiring 60% of voters to approve amending the Constitution before it can pass. The heartbeat law that went into effect earlier this year will remain the law of the land. Michael New, assistant professor of social research at the Bush School of Business at the Catholic University of America, has written about these pro-life victories in the National Review. He joins us now to tell us more about it. Michael, we just talked about Florida, Nebraska, and South Dakota's wins. Each state's measures were different. Can you explain the strategies they each used?
Sure. Florida was unique because in Florida, supporters of legal abortion needed to get 60% of the vote to amend the state constitution. So that made it a little bit easier for pro-lifers. That said, it was a difficult battle. Supporters of legal abortion probably spent over $100 billion to get Amendment 4 passed. The game changer there was Governor Ron DeSantis. He spoke out against Amendment 4. He encouraged other Republican elected officials to speak out against it. He raised money against it. He organized teams of pro-life doctors to go around the state and let people know that the current pro-life laws in Florida do allow pregnant women to receive medical care in emergency situations. So his leadership played a big, big role in the pro-life victory in Florida.
Yeah, it seems like he was very hands-on and it made a difference. In your article, you laid out the millions of dollars being spent by the abortion industry to enshrine abortion into state constitutions. Earlier in our show, we mentioned that the bishops don't think they'll be able to financially compete with pro-abortionists. Does the pro-life side simply need more money, or is there more to it?
Money certainly helps. I mean, there is a good body of research showing that the side that spends the most in direct democracy campaigns tends to win. And we saw this on Tuesday. The two other states where pro-lifers won, Nebraska and South Dakota, we did outspend our opponents. You know, the Ricketts family was very generous to us in Nebraska. They financed pro-life efforts. And supporters of legal abortion didn't show much interest in the South Dakota ballot proposition because it only legalized abortion for the first trimester. And they thought that was too much of a compromise. So fundraising is going to be an issue, but nothing's impossible. You know, it's just something that pro-lifers have to work on. It's a new challenge for us.
Can the strategies used in Florida or Nebraska be implemented in future votes, or does the pro-life cause need to adapt for each state's unique constitutional structure?
You know, I think every state's unique. I think that we have learned from ballot propositions elsewhere. Certainly, we have sustained some losses, but I think that we have learned from what happened in Ohio and Michigan. I think our outreach efforts are better. I think our ads are better. I just think that we need to make sure we can raise enough money to run effective campaigns.
Yeah. And you wrote another article for the National Review on how abortion was not a winning strategy for Democrats. Where do you see the abortion agenda going in the Democratic Party after this election?
Well, I still think you're going to see Democrats strongly support legal abortion. Many Democratic candidates and the Democratic Party as a whole get lots of money and lots of financial resources from supporters of legal abortion. So I don't really see them moderating their position in the future. And they've really shifted to the left. At one point, they supported the Hyde Amendment, or I should say at one point, they went ahead and, did support the Hyde Amendment. They did support limits on taxpayer funding for abortion. They, by and large, don't anymore. Kamala Harris during the campaign said she opposed conscience rights. So I still think you're going to see a Democratic Party that's very liberal, that really is very aggressive in their support for abortion rights.
Michael, it's always a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you.
To read about all of the ballot initiatives that passed or failed this election cycle, head over to CatholicNewsAgency.com and scroll to the bottom for an interactive map on the measures. Now we turn to life issues across the Atlantic. In Wales, the Welsh Assembly has rejected a motion to legalize assisted suicide to anyone of sound mind who is, quote, intolerably suffering, whether terminally ill or not.
Intolerable suffering is a subjective term. Where it's being used in other nations, as we've already heard, assisted suicide is being granted for all sorts of conditions, even those such as tinnitus, anorexia, as we've already heard, bed sores, and even blindness. And it can also be very, very difficult to determine if someone is of a sound mind and has a settled will.
Fewer than a third of members voted in favor of it. The leading Archbishop of Wales celebrated the news. Archbishop Mark O'Toole issued a statement writing, "Support of the most vulnerable in our society, so clearly threatened by the proposed law, is good to see." The Welsh Assembly's vote is seen as a guide on how Wales will vote on an upcoming bill in the UK Parliament proposed by Kim Leadbeater. The assisted suicide bill proposes to legalize assisted suicide for the terminally ill in England and Wales. It will be voted on November 29. Cardinal Vincent Nicholls, Archbishop of Westminster, is urging Catholics to pray that the UK bill does not pass and that human dignity is honored.
We want to pray that we will not take this step in legislation that turns, well, what is argued to be a right to die, ending up as a duty to die, and ending up on doctors as a duty to take life rather than heal, protect life.
Medical doctor and pro-life advocate Colin Miller has been following these measures and joins us now from London to talk further about it. Colin, it's a pleasure to have you with us again. Let's go back to the measures in Wales that was rejected. Is that a sign that the UK will face opposition, at least from the Welsh?
It's certainly encouraging. Wales is run by pretty far-left politicians, and typically, you know, these sorts of issues, it tends to be left-wing politicians that support. Abortion and euthanasia tends to be conservative ones that oppose it, but not necessarily. And what's really encouraging is that, you know, Wales, which is probably the most sort of left-wing part of the UK in terms of its politics and the politicians, has rejected it. And this is reflected also in, you know, we have a left-wing supermajority in our own parliament for the entire UK in Westminster. And nevertheless, a couple of really significant cabinet secretaries have said that they will oppose it as well, including the health secretary and the justice secretary. So two of the most important for this issue. So Wales only makes up a small part of the UK, so I don't think it will have necessarily a huge impact on the UK-wide vote in a couple of weeks. But it's certainly a really positive indication that even in a very secular country, in a very left-leaning country, there's significant opposition to this because of the arguments that have been made, people looking at Canada and what's gone on there, and people realizing that this isn't just an issue of religious people opposing people's autonomy. This is actually an issue of human rights, of protecting the vulnerable. And you can agree with that whether you're religious or not. And so it's certainly encouraging that we have a good chance of stopping this in a couple of weeks.
And can you tell us about the pro-life movement in the UK and how they're tackling this measure?
It's been really impressive, the way that people have mobilized. So as you probably know, the UK's had a lot of defeats on pro-life issues over the last few decades. But we've been able to hold off euthanasia, even when many other countries have legalized it. And that's not because there haven't been attempts. There have been many attempts, and every single time we've defeated it. And I think that's because we've, for once, seen a success of our representative democracy, where although most people support euthanasia, the politicians whose job it is to look into this in detail and see if it would actually work in practice, they've looked into it, and time again, they've concluded that it hasn't. And so the pro-life movement's been key to that. They've been really strong, both in terms of raising public awareness, getting pieces in the media and newspapers on TV, getting people to write to their members of parliament, which has been really crucial in getting members of parliament to commit to opposing it, but also building a broad coalition with medics, with leading palliative care doctors, with people on the right, people on the left. And really what we've seen is a huge coalition across political divides, across religious divides, and across many different sectors of society, where everyone has been understanding how harmful this is, how dangerous this is, And the pro-life movement, of course, has been crucial to building those coalitions over the last few years.
Some polls indicated there is strong support of some form of legal assisted suicide in the UK. How do we combat the narrative of so-called mercy killings?
Yeah, I mean, the polling shows that people do generally support this, maybe not as much as polls might initially indicate. And one of the reasons is that they use euphemisms like assisted dying. Mm-hmm. We already have assisted dying in the UK. It's called palliative care, where we look after people who are coming towards the end of their lives. And what they're actually trying to do is assisted suicide or euthanasia. Of course, this terminology has confused people. There was one survey that showed a significant number of people didn't actually know what assisted dying meant, and they thought it just meant something like palliative care. And so the polls are a little bit misleading at times, but it is true that most people do support it, and therefore we need to convince them that this is a bad idea. I think part of the way we do that is by showing that, yes, there are some people for whom life does really feel intolerable and who feel like they can't continue. But on the other hand, if this were to become legal, there would be many other vulnerable people who would not be victims of this. They wouldn't be sort of treated compassionately. And we point to people in Canada where people have been pressured into euthanasia, where people feel like they have to have euthanasia because they can't afford their treatment or even because they can't afford their heating bills, and many other things like this. And so I think ultimately, even if we look just through the lens of compassion, there are stories on both sides where there are people who are suffering and people who become victims of this. And it's important that we hear all of those stories in this debate, not just the people who are suffering because of their disease, but also people who suffer because of assisted suicide laws, of whom there are many.
Now, the Church of England has mixed messages on assisted suicide. The Archbishop of Canterbury, Justin Welby, who just resigned over the handling of a sex abuse scandal, called assisted dying dangerous. His predecessor, former Archbishop George Carey, is urging support for the bill. What are you hearing from Anglicans?
Yeah, I can say this as someone who goes to an Anglican church, so it's sort of my own team, that the Anglican church really offers basically no moral leadership in any respect on any issue, which is very sad, but it is the reality. And as I say that as someone who's involved in it. And that's why you see the very divergent opinions between these two former archbishops. And so the Church of England has been relatively strong in this case. I think I would say that the previous former archbishop who supports this law is probably an outlier. I would say that even though the Church of England hierarchy is extremely liberal and heterodox in many ways, I would say that the majority of them, like the majority of left-wing politicians in this country, at least that we've seen, do have serious reservations about this. And so the Church of England has been surprisingly effective, or maybe not effective, but surprisingly clear on the whole on this issue in opposing it.
Thank you, Colm. Coming up, maternity clothes, diapers, and cribs. We speak with the head of a pregnancy center in Dallas, providing new mothers with the supplies and support they need for a successful start to motherhood. Caring for a newborn is no easy task, but thanks to the help of pregnancy centers, mothers can get the spiritual, financial, and physical help they need. The White Rose Women's Center in Dallas, Texas, is one of the many centers fulfilling this great mission. The director of the program spoke with EWTN's Montse Alvarado about the incredible work they do to help new mothers.
What have you seen change since the overturning of Roe versus Wade?
Well, what we're really seeing is that girls are still getting pregnant in crisis pregnancies, and they're still needing help. They still need hope for the future. They still need assistance, and they're still seeking abortion. And quite frankly, the phone still rings here asking for help with an abortion. They know abortion is illegal in Texas, but that's irrelevant to them because it's still considered an idea. And so as long as women have that, we'll welcome them in to come in. We'll educate them about the reality of abortion, help them break down the barriers that they feel is impeding their ability to continue this pregnancy to term with confidence. So it's a wonderful opportunity when we can help them break apart those barriers, whether it be support in material or spiritual support, you know, emotional support or financial support or material things, you know. I had a girl the other day just ask me, well, I need a crib. I said, I got you. I got a crib for you when you have this baby. Okay, that's all you need. That's the easiest thing to solve.
That's so beautiful. Especially now, Julie, when you think about what's going on with inflation, prices for groceries rising around the country. You mentioned that you all give out gas cards. So you put some material backing behind the promise of being pro-life. Have you seen those needs also go up? The desire for people to who want to keep their children, want to keep their babies, want to be pro-life, even if, like you're saying, they're abortion minded. Does it change their mind, especially in an inflationary economy?
100% yes. And that's why we're so grateful for the donors that we have. We always need more donors to help fill in the gaps with material stuff and financial assistance. But absolutely, it does make all of the difference in the world when we have that girl that wants an abortion. We can say, you know, if you take a leap of faith and trust us to guide you through this whole entire journey, I've got you covered for everything you need for the baby, including maternity clothes. You know, and maternity clothes were expensive before inflation. So to be able to give them maternity clothes and help them have more confidence, even while they're pregnant, sometimes does make all the difference in the world. But definitely gas money, helping paying rent, you know, helping them get whatever they need, the electric bill, the gas bill, all of the bills that they have can sometimes be the biggest barrier to them feeling like they can do this, or even the cost of prenatal care. So we help figure out all of that. And in most cases, I'm the one providing that direct financial assistance in order to help her get going and carry this pregnancy to term.
What do you say to people who say the government should take care of us or find the solution, knowing that you are already providing a solution?
Well, we don't deal with the government at all, and we don't take government money, because if you take government money, that comes at a price, and the price is then you cannot talk about God. And so we would rather be poor and be able to help convert souls to Christ, save the spiritual life of the mother and the physical life of the baby, than be able to be rich and take in money from the government in order to have the funds.
Right.
We don't worry about that.
That's beautiful. Thank you so much, Julie.
Thank you.
You can learn more about the White Rose Women's Center and the Magdalene Program by visiting stjosephhelpers.org/programs. They list all of the services they provide and how to contact them for help. That does it for this edition of EWTN Pro-Life Weekly. Be sure to like and follow us on our social media channels. You can find us at EWTN Pro-Life on X, Facebook, and Instagram. And sign up for our newsletter, The Pro-Life Pulse, EWTN.com/pro-life. Remember, life is a gift. Your life is a gift. God bless.